Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm really happy to have as my guest David Foster Wallace and his book, Consider the Lobster and Other Essays, which is published by Little Brown. We haven't seen each other face-to-face in a couple of years, and it's been a while since he's been on the show, but he's been on the show from the very beginning. I'm particularly happy because this book reprints some of the essays that had been excluded from earlier books, like an essay on Dostoevsky and a lecture on Kafka, but also has a fabulous and scabrous essay on the pornography business and one of its conventions called Big Red Sun. It's got the famous review of John Updike. It's got a long debate, a report on the debate about American usage in grammar and vocabulary, authority in American usage, an essay on 9/11, The View from Mrs. Thompson's, an essay on sports biography, How Tracy Austin Broke My Heart. David followed the McCain campaign, but the Rolling Stone only printed a sliver of his essay. Here it is in full, called Up Simba, a gourmet magazine essay, Consider the Lobster, and a very, I think, brilliant and moving essay called Host on political talk radio. Now, as I was reading, it seemed to me that these essays really have a deep logic to them, that I'm going to start with that essay, Host, that they begin by correcting the premises of previous commentators. That essay, Host, on American talk political radio begins by saying that many of the liberals who've criticized these stations do so from a false perspective. They consider this as political commentary and journalism, when in fact, at the stations, these are considered entertainment. And therefore, the arguments, which are largely political in nature, are irrelevant to the concerns of these stations, which are about how to use forms of anger and stimulation as entertainment, and facts and correct facts are not the bases here. That seems to be the organizing point for how to consider this phenomenon of right-wing radio, and the essay seems to be about reaching conclusions based on correct and corrected premises.
Well, if there's a thing that a lot of the long pieces in this book have in common is that to a large extent they're about ideology. And I don't know. I do know that in doing some of the reading, the research reading for the talk radio piece, there's a sort of paradox or trap that I'm sure you're aware of, which is that things divide very neatly into two camps, and there are apologists and opponents. And so that most articles about talk radio that run in organs like, you know, The Nation, Dissent, Harper's, are blistering attacks on it, focused almost entirely on what's pernicious and or wrong. The rather loose relationship with facts is made much of. Then, you know, if you read the American Standard or some of the more conservative organs, they're very different, and their arguments have to do more with the fact that radio, including talk radio, was for many years guided by ideology without anybody ever having said so, and that now suddenly that there are voices on the right that are in some ways correcting or balancing the liberal media bias. Now all of a sudden, people on the left are all right. And so it's almost like listening to an old married couple argue with each other, where pretty much everybody has a point, but it's clear that there's a larger problem, which is that these are two sides that are not having any kind of meaningful conversation with each other. To the extent that there was a project in the talk radio piece, it was to try to do just about the only different thing I could think of to do, which was to do a piece where there was certainly the appearance of trying to be a great deal more fair and broad-minded to right-wing talk radio than right-wing talk radio itself was to its opponents, and to try to an extent to look at or balance both sides.
Now, in the essay about Tracy Austin, you come to an interesting conclusion, and I think of it as being sort of a paradigm for the way these essays find themselves thinking. First, let me say that the essays are what I truly enjoy, thought in action, that in reading them, you're going to be following certain lines of argument, suspending them for consideration of an opposite, that there's a kind of muscular activity of mind going on here in addition to a lot of fun and a lot of moral consideration. You say about the Tracy Austin book that it breaks your heart because you've loved watching her. She's a tragic figure in the sports community. The autobiography comes out, or as told to, and it contains none of the understanding of what it might feel like to be on the playing field making any number of immediate instinctual decisions, what that feels like, what it's like to be wired in that way, what it's like to be a genius of that sort. And then the essay concludes with the idea that perhaps being a genius of that sort precludes being able to have to voice distinctions and careful choices, that the immediacy of the sport is born out of a body's response immediately without intervention of the mind. This seemed to me to be a very generous way of saying that the verbal art operates independently of the trained body, and that these books are striving toward something that a sports person can't even be expected to start to do.
See, you do a way better job of describing these things than I would. I know whatever muscularity there is in a piece like the Tracy Austin or the Lobster one had to do with the fact that some of these start out as sort of magazine assignments, and they end up. Oh, I don't know how to explain this. I don't know a whole lot about nonfiction journalism, all this sort of stuff. The way that I think about these things, and in terms of what I can do, is I almost think that this is kind of a little bit of a service industry, and that these essays like this are occasions to watch somebody reasonably bright but also reasonably average pay far closer attention and think at far more length about all sorts of different stuff than most of us have a chance to in our daily lives. I mean, to the extent to which I understand what I'm trying to do in these pieces, it's that. I'm remembering the word because it's compliment. What you're referring to is this muscularity. Some pieces that have a certain problem end up being good enough that, like, I'll put them in a book. The problem will be I did a review of the Tracy Austin autobiography, which maybe now is somewhat dated. I know people under 30 who don't even know who Tracy Austin was. But the first great nymphet prodigy of the female tennis world in the 70s and 80s, and someone whom I grew up watching. Well, the problem is that, and I mean this with no offense, from any kind of literary point of view, the book's a train wreck. It's banal, it's insipid, in places it's incoherent. And the problem with, you know, I'm sure you've written book reviews too, one can really make the point and back it up with examples in like two paragraphs. And then what is there to say that makes this an interesting piece of writing? In the Tracy Austin thing, the thing that ended up and that the piece ended up being about was I decided to pay attention to something rather different, which is why did I expect this to be better? And why this the genre of sports autobiographies happens to be one of the subgenres that I have this kind of guilty addiction to. I read, at least did read, huge numbers of them, and almost every one involved this sort of this sense of kind of angry betrayal or disappointment, because they were never as interesting as I was sure they were going to be. And so really, to the extent that it's an essay, it ends up being about why would a more or less averagely intelligent person like these things when they're so dreadful? And B, what is it about them? I guess you don't say one and B. One, why I like them. Two, what exactly is it that makes them so bitterly disappointing for somebody who, say, played sports as a kid? And so that ends up being what it's about. The same way that the Lobster essay, I mean, nothing personal, but the Maine Lobster Festival was really kind of boring, and there wasn't very much to write about. The only thing that was interesting was that it was this entire thing devoted to the pleasures of boiling alive and eating lobster, and on the fringes you had people from PETA who were offering a very different template through which to look at the experience of eating lobster, and so that's what the piece ended up being about.
PETA stands for?
I believe it's People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
I'm speaking with David Foster Wallace. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. David's new book is Consider the Lobster and Other Essays, published by Little Brown. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with David Foster Wallace about his book of essays, Consider the Lobster. The lobster essay comes to a kind of breaking point at which it addresses its reader and says, you, reader of Gourmet magazine, don't want to be told about the potential pain of the lobster. But on the other hand, who would be more appropriate to tell? And so the essay takes on a kind of sense of its place and form, sense of direct logical address to its audience, telling its audience why they need to be addressed this way, because in fact, who would care more or could be expected to care more than the readers of Gourmet magazine, if these readers, in fact, want to be informed and are thinking deeply about lobster?
Well, but it depends. I mean, it's predicated on my admitting that there are certain things, certain gustatory things I don't know. One of the things that was interesting about that piece is the subtitle of Gourmet magazine is The Magazine of Good Living, right? When you start looking at a phrase like good living, obviously, there are all kinds of different ways that you can interpret it. Here's another weird thing about this book. There are three or four of the pieces in here that are nearly, to me, inexplicable unless frequent acknowledgement is made in the piece that they are appearing in a certain organ. Rolling Stone in the McCain piece is another example I can think of. What was interesting to me is that at the time that the magazines were chopping them up and deciding to run them, they seemed somehow allergic to the idea of the article talking about the organ in which it was appearing and what certain demographic or rhetorical considerations followed from that. So the only place that I have – that I really have space and permission to talk in detail about that is in the book. But of course, well, now that it's in the book, it's in fact not in that organ. And so it all ends up being extremely strange.
But in relation, for instance, to the lobster essay, that idea about good living being a widely definable concept, which would include living in conscious awareness of one's environment and what one does to it, these essays often unfold gradually into subjects, I would say, larger than their occasions, often the subject of morality in what might be considered a largely post-moral age. And what becomes very interesting to me is that as a young writer, you might be considered an avatar or spokesperson for the post-moral age. So watching David Wallace in these essays parsing moral distinctions and insisting, no, I don't feel comfortable doing the humor piece on the Maine Lobster Festival. What's more, occasioned by the festival, I've been approached by people with pamphlets who've told me about what animals suffer. But I still want to continue eating certain things. So the essay becomes an attempt for the author to demonstrate a kind of moral relativism for his reader. That's what thrilled me about it.
Other than arguing with you about whether I'm in any way a young writer anymore, I'm just curious. Avatar of the post-moral age, how? Like, what do you mean by moral and post-moral?
I think that until I read this book of essays, for many reasons, I didn't know where you stood politically. I had certain assumptions. When, in the course of the 9/11 essay, you visit a neighbor of yours who attends the same church you go to, I say to myself, gee, I didn't know David Foster Wallace goes to church. That's interesting. Think of the apocalyptic complexity of the fiction as being not necessarily the work of someone I expect going to church and visiting neighbors to watch their TV, that kind of thing.
You know more about this than I. My sense is that somehow around the time of modernism, literary stuff, meaning not mass market, I mean the kind of stuff you talk about on your show, has become almost exclusively an aesthetic enterprise. I guess I associate moral with the word moral with self-righteousness and judgment, and so it makes me
– Oh, not at all.
But then I don't like post-moral either because it sounds amoral. All I can tell you is that because as I'm driving on the terrifying freeways down here, I'm thinking about okay, so what general thing to say about these kind of nonfiction pieces is a lot of it involves, as far as I can see, just a service. The ordinary person is going to the Maine Lobster Festival in order to rest and escape from complicated, stressful, unpleasant parts of their life. Between that and little kids tugging at your pant cuff, you don't have time really to sit and noodle the average person for long periods of time about what this experience is like, what assumptions you bring to bear to it, what conclusions are to be reached. And for the very few Americans who have a taste for that sort of thing, I think these essays simply provide, here's somebody who really went absolutely to the wall, dropping all the attention filters, trying to pay attention to absolutely everything and figure out, including his own responses and his own ideological templates, and trying his very best to figure out what the truth is.
One of the reasons I liked seeing the Dostoevsky essay reprinted, although my sense is that it's slightly older than some of the other pieces, was that it ends on a question of how a novelist today might aspire toward the ethical, moral, spiritual authority that Dostoevsky attained, and wonders whether that's even possible. But in the course of wondering, the essay identifies you, David Wallace, as someone who likes to write fiction, who regards fiction considered from a solely aesthetic standpoint as being insufficient, but who finds the big questions hard to address and sometimes ridiculous to consider addressing in the direct and extreme ways that Dostoevsky found. So, you know, it is, maybe the word moral should be ethical, but at any rate, putting this, rather than solely aesthetic dimensions at the center of the piece or amusement, this had better be funny or I'm out of here, but to find a way to bring these pieces to a concern with the ethics of the community seemed to me to be heroic and beautiful.
Do I possibly want to argue with that? I mean, the Dostoevsky thing, which is older, is in there partly because as with the last four or five books, I mean, I have a really good editor, and so the things that are in here are in here and in here in an order that's meant to establish connections that may not be, you know what, they may not be obvious to anybody but me and him. But one of them has to do with, boy, see, some of this stuff's so complicated it's hard even to talk about. Ideology, or what you might call, Stanley Cavell would call it, conditions that have to do with an audience's willingness to be pleased. So that when you use words like moral or ethical, those to me connote a situation that's really good for the kind of era in which Dostoevsky, or, you know, in Europe, maybe the Romantics were writing. And this involves the, quote, artist as this kind of solitary, heroic figure wrestling with his own soul and finding a way to turn that struggle into art for the reader. It, you know, maybe what I would say about that just makes me sound like an avatar of some kind of post-moral thing. But it seems to me, having been born in 1962 and having grown up without any memory of a life without television, for example, is that in fact what we have when you talk about stuff like the Dostoevsky or ethical or moral dimensions to art is we really have what appear to me to be two different problems who are related in complicated ways. One is the classic one of just deciding, the writer decides the way all of us have to decide, what is it to be a human being? What is it to find some way to make an accommodation with being an individual and being self-centered, but also being part of a larger group and loving some people and not, you know, all that stuff, all the old romantic stuff. But then with the other concerns appear to me to be to be more rhetorical or technical. Something that doesn't get talked about very much in any era I know of up till, you know, maybe the postmodern era, is that these are public documents and works of art that are not meant simply to be expressive. They're not meant simply to be spontaneous effusions from an individual soul. They are also They're also communications and pieces of art that are designed to please, gratify, edify whatever other human beings. So that you've got not just what's true for me as a person, but what's gonna sound true, what's gonna hit readers or music listeners or whatever, what's gonna hit their nerve endings as true in 2006 or 2000 or 1995. And it seems to me, I mean, I may have kind of a pessimistic view of it, but it seems to me that the situation, the environment in which nervous systems receive these communications is vastly more complicated, difficult, cynical, and overhyped than it used to be. The easy example is that and one that I go through over and over with, you know, students in writing classes is that these students are far more afraid of coming off as sentimental than they are of coming off twisted, obscene, gross, any of the things that used to be that used to be the really horrible things that you didn't want to betray about yourself. And it would appear that the great danger of appearing sentimental is that sentimentality is mainly now used in what appear to be very cynical marketing or mass entertainment devices that are meant to sort of manhandle the emotions of large numbers of people who aren't paying very close attention. So that some of the most urgent themes or issues, how to deal with mourning the loss of somebody you love very much, has been so adulterated by sort of treacly cynical commercial art that it becomes very, very, very difficult to think about how to talk about it in a way that's not just more of that crap.
I've been speaking with David Foster Wallace, author most recently of Consider the Lobster and Other Essays, published by Little Brown. Thank you, David, for joining me. Thank you. You can read an excerpt from Consider the Lobster on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.